Thank you, Robin. My name is Doug Mefford. I am an alcoholic.
Amen.
Thanks to the grace of a loving God and the 12 steps and strong sponsorship, I've been a drink since August 15th of 1994. I'd like to welcome y'all to the Friday night speaker meeting of the 38th annual Atlanta Roundup. If you would, please help me open this meeting with a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer. Serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thank you. Introduce the speaker. First things first, I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to participate and introduce my good friend Mike. I'm new to the area. I relocated here in January, so it's a bunch of strange faces in a familiar place, and I'm glad to get to know those that I have and look forward to getting to know those that I haven't yet. But it's a real honor to get an opportunity to introduce Mike. Mike and I have known each other. We've been running in some of the same AA circles for a few years now, and I can tell you this, he's a fine AA member. And the example of that is his action. When I moved to Atlanta, I was here 5 days. I went to a meeting on a Saturday night. He and his wife and a group of the people from their home group jumped in a van and came 3.5 hours so I could see a familiar face. That's the kind of man that you're going to hear from tonight, and he is one of my best friends. And he's one of my heroes in AA. And I'm glad to introduce you to my good friend and soon to be yours, Mike B. from Etowah, North Carolina.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Mike Burns.
Hey, Mike.
It's good to be back in Atlanta. I am honored to be here tonight. And I had the privilege of coming and talking to a few groups here in Atlanta back in February and met a good bunch of people here. And I've actually made some lifelong friends here. And it's just absolutely incredible. And, thanks, Doug, for that introduction. You know, I met Doug in 2007 out in Oklahoma, and we just hit it off. You know, we've been good friends ever since, and we've been able to spend a lot of time together, and it's been absolutely incredible. I'm an alcoholic, and I am so grateful that that's all I have to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous today. You know, and my sponsor told me if I call myself anything other than an alcoholic in AA, then I'm setting myself apart from. I'm saying I'm a little bit different, and I don't want to be different. You people absolutely saved my life. This program, is there no doubt in my mind that this program saved my life. You know, so, I'm just grateful that where I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I came into a lot of good, strong, old-timers in AA, you know, and I got in with these old guys. And I have a home group. It's called the Big Town Group, and we meet in the small town of Etowah, North Carolina. I always say Etowah, population 49, we got 48 home group members. And got one sitting right back over here. And but it's, you know, I mean, it's, I've got a sobriety date, September 17th of 1992, and I've got a sponsor down in Greenville, South Carolina, named Bob McKay. And I love that man, and I just got to hear his wife talk this Wednesday night up in Hendersonville, North Carolina. But, it's just, it's an honor to be here, and I'd like to thank everybody who had any part in getting me here. You know, it's always a privilege to be able to participate in my own recovery and to be here with, you know, some of my heroes, and it just absolutely blows me away sometimes. I was born in Charlotte, North Carolina back in the 60s, and I was born into a good family. My dad actually left my mom when she was pregnant with me. And my mom had three small kids, and I was on the way, and she couldn't work, so my grandparents took us in their home, and I got raised up in a great home where my grandparents was real active in a Lutheran church, and they did everything they were supposed to do. You know, they taught us right from wrong, good from bad. You know, they taught us about respect, treat people like you would want to be treated, all those things that we're supposed to learn when we're growing up, you know. And my earliest memories was I was scared to death as a kid. If you weren't in my family, I was afraid of you. Even going in this church I grew up in, I was afraid of these church people, you know. I could always remember as a little kid hiding behind my grandma's leg, you know, peeking around at these people, trying to pinch me in the cheek. You know, I was afraid. I was scared to death of these people. And I took my first drink at 11 years old. And I don't remember it, but I do remember my first drunk, and I was 12 years old, camping out in the backyard with some friends. And alcohol did something for me that night that nothing has ever done for me. And alcohol gave me power. And I found out real early when I started drinking, when I felt the effects produced by alcohol, I can go places I normally can't go. I can be around people I normally can't be around, and I can do things I normally can't do. You know, and why wouldn't I drink? I drank every chance I got. I was kind of like in the big book in chapter to the Gnostics, it talks about we neatly evaded God. When I started drinking at 12 years old, I started evading that God and that church that I grew up in. And by the time I was 15 years old, I drank every day. And then the big book talks about we entirely ignored. And that's what I did. I entirely ignored God. I hear people talk about foxhole prayers, you know. You get me out of this and I won't, you know. I never remember saying anything like that, you know. And so I believe I was self-will run right then, you know, at 15 years old, you know. And I made up my own rules. I didn't like living by the rules of my family, by the church I was in, by society, you know. I was a blackout drinker, too, and I'd come to in some of the strangest places, places I never dreamed I'd come to. I went to a New Year's Eve party in Charlotte, North Carolina at 15 years old. I came to in Daytona Beach, Florida, you know. I don't know how I got there. I stayed on the streets for 3 weeks and got locked up my first time in Lakeland, Florida. And they sent me back on probation. I got back. My mama told me to turn myself in, and I said, for what? And me and my buddy had robbed a little old lady in the neighborhood park, 15 years old, and I don't remember doing that. So that should have told me that alcohol was bad for me. I ought not drink. How many times have you heard that? You ought not drink. But, man, it didn't matter to me. I found out real early. Consequences of my drinking did not matter because of what alcohol did for me. It gave me that power I needed to go places I normally can't go, do things I normally can't do, and be around the people I normally can't be around. And so, you know, I was in and out of jail until I got sober. And I remember I hated going to school with a passion, man. I remember I was scared to death going to the first grade because it was a strange place, didn't know anybody. I walked in there and they set me down at this table with three other guys and two guys sitting across from me. And I don't know what came over me, but I just spit right on the guy in front of me. And they put me out in the hallway. So I'm a quick study, you know. If I get in trouble in the classroom, they'll put me out there by myself. I like being by myself. So I stayed in a lot of trouble. I made good grades up until the fifth grade. And I started drinking, you know. My grades started dropping off. And, you know, I just didn't like going to school, you know. Me and the guys would meet in the morning. We'd walk the railroad tracks to school in the morning. 13, 14 years old. We'd pitch our lunch money in and get the winos to get us something to drink. So we was drinking that good Orange Jubilee and, you know, Mad Dog 22, all that good stuff on the way to school in the morning. As a little kid, a lot of times we'd overshoot the mark and wouldn't make it to school, you know. And so I just stopped going to school on a regular basis in the sixth grade. You know, I didn't get no education. And I remember I went through junior high school. I made D's and F's, seventh through ninth grade. They passed me every year. They sent me to the 10th grade. And the only thing I can tell y'all about the 10th grade is it was the funnest 3 years of my life, you know. And, we'd show up in the front door and head out the back and go out and drink, you know. And but like I said, I was a blackout drinker. I'd come to in places I never dreamed I'd come to. I'd come to in some of the worst places in Charlotte, North Carolina. I remember one time I came to on a horseback. I was riding a horse, chasing this good-looking blonde through the woods, and finally, when I called her, I found out it was my sister. She bailed me out of some trouble, and she thought she had sobered me up by putting me on a horse. Man, she needed Al-Anon bad back then. I come to one time doing 70 mile an hour through a field. And I went about to get back up on the road, and I started rolling. And we rolled about five or six times, and I just left the van laying for dead, you know, went on. And that's just what we did. So, you know, it was just, my drinking was pretty crazy for a long time. Like I said, I quit school. My mama told me, if you ain't going to go to school or go to work, you need to, or if you're not going to go to school, you need to go to work. So I quit school, went to work. I went to work doing carpenter work and found out them guys drank on the job, you know, and I kind of liked that. And so I think I made the brilliant decision then that every job I ever get, I'm going to find one I can drink on, you know. And I worked with these guys from North Wilkesboro. This guy named Harley, and he had five sons, and they were a framing crew in Charlotte, North Carolina. You know, back in the 70s and early 80s, they probably built every apartment complex in Charlotte, you know, and it was prefab apartments. I went to work with them guys, and they drank corn liquor and smoked homegrown. That's what they did. And so we'd go to work and start drinking, you know. We was up on the second floor one time waiting on the forklift driver to come bring us some walls up to us. And I remember the superintendent over the whole job came up the ladder. And he said, "Where's Harley at?" And we looked around, and he was just standing right there with us. And then here come Harley up the ladder. And we didn't know, but on the way home, Harley told us. He was up there with us. Harley turned around and stepped off the second floor of that building. And drinking that corn liquor, you know, you don't get affected too bad when you're drinking like that. And so he just came right back up the ladder. Now, those are the kind of guys that I would seek out to work for, because you can't get fired working for those kind of people, you know. You just get tired of working for them, and move on, you know. You never get fired from them people. And so those are the things that I was doing. I remember I was walking the streets at night, you know, and I thought, I can't wait to get my driver's license, you know. I was 21 years old. I went and got my license. And I wanted to find a job driving one of their vehicles because all my money went on drinking, you know. So I found a job installing cable TV for a contracting company in Charlotte, and they gave me this big, long Dodge van to work out of. And I'll tell you, when I'm not comfortable staying somewhere, I'll just move on, you know, and if I can stay on the streets if I have to. But they gave me this big, long van, and I moved in that van. I packed my clothes up, moved in there, and I'd park down on dead-end roads, you know, in Charlotte, or I'd pull down on this creek bank where I grew up, or all the drunks hung out on the creek bank. And I remember one night I was down on this creek bank, and this girl came up, and you never knew who was going to come up on these woods down there. And I had met this girl in church when I was 7 years old, you know, so I knew who she was. And she didn't like where she was living, so I let her move in with me, you know. And my best friend was 23 years old, and his daddy wouldn't let him in his house, but he let him sleep out in the backyard in a 56 Chevrolet station wagon. And it was sitting on blocks, and he put a tarp over it where you couldn't see in or out of it. And his daddy let him have a drop cord to hook power up out there in his car. Well, his girlfriend lived with him for 3 years out in his station wagon. So he got him a strip plug where you can hook six different appliances up to it. Had a little heater for the winter, a fan for the summer, a little color TV, stereo, you know. And doing the work I did, I hooked his HBO and Cinemax up for him, so... Good fight, come on HBO, we're going over to their house, you know what I mean? I don't know about y'all, but two couples drinking in tight quarters like that, things happen, you know. And we'd roll out in the backyard fighting, and finally his daddy got tired of it and run us all off, you know. Being the good friend I was, I let them move in with us. And so we got two couples living in a Cablevision truck, right? And it wasn't long after they moved in, things started going downhill. I don't know how roommates, they never do what you want them to do, right? Like Scott wouldn't take out the trash when it needed to go out, or, you know. It was rough. Them were some good times, believe it or not. But I remember we used to drink at a place called Hubie's Bubble Up. Now, I met somebody from Mooresville earlier. He knows about Hubie's Bubble Up down on the Catawba River. It was an old biker bar that they condemned. But everybody would camp out down there, and that's where we'd stay. And there was a trailer park out there. Y'all familiar with drunk trailer parks in Atlanta, right? I mean, the whole trailer park just stayed drunk. And But a lot of the guys I was working with lived in this trailer park, and these guys, one of them said, Mike, my boy ain't never been to a bar. I said, well, I'll take him. And so I took him to Charlotte, and I got me a fifth of George Dickel White Label, bought him a 12-pack, and I was chasing my liquor with his beer, and we hitting bars all up and down Central Avenue in Charlotte. And I remember I wanted to take a drink, and I told that boy, grab the steering wheel so I could take me a drink. And he did, and I turned that liquor up and chased it, and blue lights come on. I pulled over, and the cop come up to my window, and I asked the cop, I said, was I speeding? He said, no, you crossed that center line back there. Well, I leaned back and said, well, you don't talk to this boy over here. He was steering, right? And I still say they locked up the wrong guy. I didn't cross the center line, right? Now, he didn't give me no roadside test. He drug me out by the hair of the head and locked me up, you know, impounded our home. You know, by this time, I'd been locked up so many times in Charlotte, North Carolina. I had a bondsman named Blue. He'd get me out on credit, meet me at the bank on Fridays. And so Blue come got me, and I walked the streets of Charlotte, and I knew where that van was going. They told me where they was going to tow it to, and I went and got my van out of impoundment and went to work the next day. Very next weekend, I got another DWI in Lincolnton, North Carolina. They impounded our home again. You know, and it just kept getting worse and worse. You know, we got a larceny charge in that van. You can't run from the Mecklenburg County Police at 3 o'clock in the morning in a Cablevision van. You can't get away from them. And so it just kept getting worse. I quit the job. They said, why are you quitting? I said, it costs too much money to work for you people, you know. So I went back to the streets of Charlotte. Well, I found out real quick, when you don't have a job or your car, your girlfriend will leave you. She left. And so I went back to the streets of Charlotte, and I'm walking the streets at night and staying wherever I can, you know. I'd go in these bars, and I'd set people up with some beers, and I'd get on their side, and I'd say, let's get a half gallon of liquor and go over to your house. And I'd get in your house, and I'd just stay as long as I could, you know. And sometimes it might be, you know, almost a year sometimes. But I remember I was in this bar one night, and this girl came in, and she said, aren't you Bobby's brother? And I said, yeah. I hadn't seen my brother in about 5 years. And she took me over into North Charlotte, and we pulled up in this driveway, and there's 30 Harley-Davidson motorcycles out in that yard. And we walked in this house, and man, them bikers was in there drinking half gallons of liquor right out of the bottle. Man, they had guns strapped on them, and I felt comfortable. And I just stayed there with them, you know. Come to find out, my brother was the president of a club there in Charlotte, and that was their clubhouse. And I moved in with them guys. A couple of them are brick masons. They put me to work mixing mortar and hauling brick for them. And we drank around the clock, you know. Whenever you came to, you just started drinking. And that was the way it was. And I remember one night, I think me and Toad and Snake was sitting there drinking a half gallon of Jim Beam. And the bathroom door down the hall opened up, and out stepped this beautiful Mi'kmaq Indian. She had hair down to her belt. I had hair down to my belt. She had more tattoos than I got, and that impressed me because I got a whole bunch of them. But I blacked out and passed out and don't know what happened. The next day when I came to, she was gone. And I was hoping she would still been there, but she was gone. And so about a month later, I was in a bar, and she walked in this bar with this young guy with her. And she came straight over to me and said, Mike, I'm taking you home with me tonight. I said, okay. I was pretty easy when I was drunk. My wife says I'm still pretty easy. But she took me home with her. She lived in, anybody familiar with Charlotte, Old Concord Road. There was an evergreen trailer park. You talking about a drunk trailer park. They should have condemned this place in the 50s. And she lived in the smallest trailer in this trailer park. And I'll tell you, when you walked in the front door, if you was drunk, it leaned back like that. When you walked in drunk, you just went straight back to the back wall, you know. And you just slide down the highway And we got in there with a fifth of Jim Beam, and I remember the wind was blowing so hard, I thought the trailer was going to blow over, you know. So we passed out. When we came to, we went outside of that trailer, and there was pine trees laying through trailers. And we didn't know what happened, and we went over and knocked on the neighbor's door to find out what happened. Hurricane Hugo hit that night. It tore Charlotte, North Carolina up, you know. And so being there with a woman in my dreams, I just never left, you know. And, well, I couldn't leave. We couldn't drive out of the trailer park. But we stayed drunk for the next 11 days, and we became best drinking buddies. And we ended up getting married in a beer joint down in Charleston, South Carolina. Her sister married us. A lot of people used to say, y'all ain't really married. I knew we were because I had to pay for the divorce. But we stayed drunk, you know. We stayed drunk. And both of us in and out of jails. And we loved to fight. We didn't fight each other. We fought people, you know. We'd go into the ballroom and start some stuff and get a whole crowd of them out there swinging. And but I remember, here's a great story, man. We was in a bar one night, and this girl, we come out of the bar, and there was five women sitting on the hood of this car. And they hollered out, biker trash, and I couldn't believe that. My wife grabbed hold of one of them, and so they all jumped on her and started swinging. And me and my brother's girlfriend was standing there watching, and they was all on top of her. And all I seen was a tattooed arm sticking out from the bottom of the pile. So we just grabbed her and drug her out. And these women are still hitting each other. The cops pull up and say, "What's going on?" I said, "Well, they fighting." And we just walked back in the bar, you know. But, I mean, it was just... And see, those were fun times for me. I don't know about y'all. That was just great stuff. But we was in a bar one night and a fight broke out. And this was a tight bar. When a fight breaks out, everybody jumps in. And we both jumped in. And next thing you know, I came to in a jail cell. And I didn't know why I was in there. And I pulled my papers out of my pocket. And the paper said that I assaulted a female in the barroom. And I don't remember hitting no woman in this fight, you know. And I remember I got out on bond that day. And I went home. And we lived in a little efficiency apartment. And I walked in there. And all her stuff was gone. And there was two boxes sitting by the front door. And I started drinking, and it wasn't long after that, she came in the door with one of her friends, and I saw who I hit in that ballroom, and I put 15 stitches in my wife's head. And that tore me up, because I don't hit women, you know. I was raised, you don't hit a woman, and I've always believed that. And so she got her stuff and got out of there, and I got evicted out of this place, and I went back to the streets of Charlotte, North Carolina, you know, and I would use people up, and I'd walk the streets at night, you know, and I'll tell you, I was getting tired of living the way I was living. And I'd never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. I never heard of treatment. I didn't know that there was people who lived like that that found a way out through Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know that, you know. And so I remember I found her over in North Charlotte, and I begged and pleaded with her to get back together. And she said, "Mike, if you move back to your mama's house and quit drinking, we might get back together." You know, that's the last place any man wants to go at 28 years old, back to mama's house, you know. And I remember I'd walk the streets and not think about it. And finally, I did. My mama always told me I could come home. And I went back home, you know. And it wasn't long after that, we had to go to court. My wife got there before I did. And I remember the DA and my wife tried to drop the charges, and they wouldn't do it. It was a state against me. And I went up there prepared to go to prison that day. You know, all the guys I grew up with, every one of them been in and out of prison most of their life, you know. And I just figured it was my turn. And I remember the DA read the charge to the judge and told the judge what happened. And the judge looked at my wife and said, "What do you want to do with him?" And she got up and told that judge, she said, "Mike's a good man." Said he works hard, he helps his family when they need help, but he's crazy when he drinks. And I drank every day. And that's all she said, and she sat down. And I remember the judge told me to stand up, and I stood up, and it seemed like I stood there forever. And the judge, what I heard him say was, "2 years in the penitentiary or AA?" Well, you ain't got to be the head cashier at Walmart to figure out the better deal, right? I don't know what AA is, but I know it ain't prison. So, but he gave me a 2-year sentence suspended with 2 years supervised probation, sent me to a treatment center to take an assessment, sent me to another program for 6 months, and he sent me down the hall to meet my PO officer. Man, that was the meanest woman I ever met in my life. And she said, "Mike, when you have an appointment to see me, if you're late, I'm going to lock you up." And I'd go early, and she'd cuss me out for coming too early. And I'll tell you, you know, like I said, I was tired of living the way I was living, but I didn't know there was a way out. And I remember I was just willing to do anything that woman told me to do because I didn't want to go to prison 2 years. And so she sent me over to this treatment center to take an assessment, and I didn't know what that was. And it seemed like they had 100 questions, and it seemed like it took me forever to answer them. And I lied on most of them. And I remember I got one of them wrong, and they told me I was an alcoholic. And that's exactly how I felt, you know. And they said, "You need to come into treatment." I said, "Well, I got to work." So they gave me outpatient treatment. Thank God that the judge sent me to a treatment facility who took the group to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and they took me to an AA meeting. And I'll tell you, on a Tuesday night, I walked in. The first AA meeting I went to was the Hawthorne group in Charlotte, North Carolina. I walked in this group with about 70 or 80 people sitting in there. The first two people I see is my junior high school principal sitting beside my Sunday school teacher. And that Sunday school teacher's daughter is the one who lived in that van with me, and I was kind of worried about that. But I'll tell you, I stood in the doorway of that meeting, and I looked over the room of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thought, man, I'm not like these people, you know. I could put my hair in my back pocket. I had my teeth kicked out fighting. I am covered up in tattoos, and everybody looked all cleaned up, shiny in there, you know. And I just didn't know once people get sober, they get, you know, they change. They clean up, and, you know, they look different. And but I didn't know anything about that, you know. I just didn't feel like I fit in here. But I came, you know, and I heard the solution. Just don't drink and go to meetings. That's all I needed to do. I knew that. And that's what I did for the next 8 months. I came to these meetings, and I just didn't drink, and that was it. And I remember me and my wife got back together, and she was still drinking, and she'd take me and drop me off and pick me up, and we'd go to the bars. And she drank liquor, and I drank the chaser, you know. And that kept getting worse and worse. And I told her, I said, look, I can't go to these bars no more. And she said, well, I'll quit too. So she came into AA. We went to some meetings together, you know, and she just quit coming. And I remember coming to these meetings, you know, for 8 months, just not drinking and going to meetings, my life on the outside looked better, you know. I got me a good job, a job that fired me back in the 80s for coming in drunk every day. And I'll tell you, if I could have got a DWI on a forklift, I'd have got more than one in that place. But they hired me back when I was in treatment. And so I had a good job, you know. And me and her were back together. We got us a nice apartment, started buying furniture out of the store, started getting off the side of the road somewhere. And, you know, things was looking better after 8 months of not drinking and going to meetings. Well, after 8 months of not going, you know, not drinking, I was at work one day and I thought to myself, you ain't had a drink in 8 months. Surely you can drink a couple beers. It'll be all right. So I went home and started an argument with her and packed my clothes up and went and got a hotel room at the old Charlotte Coliseum Motel. Got me a 12-pack. I remember going over to the grocery store. I put a 12-pack under my arm and I was looking for the AA people, you know. Scared to death they was going to see me. They was going to stop me from controlled drinking. And went over there and locked all four locks on the door and started drinking them beers. Nothing happened to me. Drank two or three more. And I don't know about y'all, but when I get a buzz, there's always something better happening across town. And I took off across town, you know, and I walked in a bar and the bartender was pouring a double shot of tequila. He started putting some Tabasco sauce in there, and I knew that was my drink. And he said, where you been, Mike? I said, man, I've been sober in AA for 8 months. He said, boy, you need this. And I turned that double shot up and said, give me another one. I don't remember leaving that bar. I came to the next day at 11 o'clock on the bathroom floor of that hotel room, sick as I ever been. And I remember I climbed up on the sink and I looked in the mirror and I looked like a wild animal. And I didn't like anything about what I saw in that mirror. I didn't want to live like that, you know. I used to say, I don't know why I came back to AA that night. My old sponsor in Charlotte, a guy named Buck, told me, he said, Buck, Mike, you go to AA for 8 months, AA put a booger on you. If you're here tonight, if you plan on drinking some more, you've been boogered up. It ain't no fun no more. But I came back to AA that night. That was September the 17th of 1992. And by God's grace and you people helping me, I hadn't had to take a drink since then, you know. My wife got drunk, stayed drunk for a couple weeks, and I lived in my van for 2 weeks. And I was going to meetings every day, and every night. And I was going to work in the daytime. I was going to a lot of AA meetings, you know, and I was the kind of guy who, what do you do when you don't drink? I don't know, you know. So I would just go to AA meetings, and I went to a lot of them. And I remember I was going to this group called Late Night Eastside, and they met on Friday and Saturday night, and there was probably 70, 80 people at that meeting every Friday and Saturday night at 10 o'clock. And it was like a pocket of enthusiastic drunks, man. I'm telling you, they took meetings to the prison. They took it to mental health, to treatment facilities, you know, and they would go in packs of, you know, five, six, eight people, you know, and I got in with that group. And I remember I'd stand outside with these guys, and they would say stuff like, "Mike, if you go where we go and do what we do, you don't ever have to drink again." And they'd say, "Even better than that, you don't ever have to be alone again." And they hooked me, and I got in that group, you know. I got a sponsor in that group. And I remember I asked this guy to be my sponsor, and he said, "Mike, are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober?" Well, he didn't tell me what that looked like, but I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Will you freely give away what was freely given to you?" I don't know what they were going to give me, but I said, "Yeah." And I didn't have a clue, you know. I just wanted him to say, "I'll be your sponsor," you know. And so he agreed to be my sponsor. He said, "You got a home group?" I said, "No." I said, "I don't know what it is." And he told me what it was. And he said, "Late Night East Side is my home group." I said, "Well, I guess it's mine too, you know." And so the first week I was a member of that group, they had a group conscious meeting. He said, "We need to be here early." And so I come early and walked in there to this group conscious meeting. Didn't know what it was. Walked in, and they didn't ask me if I wanted to do anything. They said, "Mike, you going to chair the meeting on Friday night and make coffee on Saturday night?" And all I did was say, "Well, show me how, you know." And they would show up and show me how to do this stuff, you know. Thank God for those guys. And they knew exactly what I needed, you know. When I started doing something in Alcoholics Anonymous is when I felt like I became a member, when I felt like I was a part of, you know. And so, you know, them guys knew exactly what they were doing, you know. It wasn't long after that I was elected grapevine rep in the group. You know, I didn't know, "What do you do now?" You know, and they told me how to do that. And I started learning a little bit of the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. My sponsor's sponsor was in that group. And he said, "Mike, there's a district meeting coming up this Sunday." He said, "Why don't you meet me over here?" I said, "Okay." I just figured it was another AA meeting. I walked in there. They said, "We need a district grapevine rep." And the guy said, "I nominate Mike." And they all raised their hand. They said, "You're it." And I'm like, "What is it?" You know? They said, "Don't worry. We'll show you how," you know? And so, and I remember my sponsor told me something that I really believe is important. He said, "Mike, if you ever take a service position in Alcoholics Anonymous, give it 100% or don't take it." Because there's a lot of people with a name on their back that don't do the work that really needs to be done here. And so I'm grateful that he told me that, you know. And I've had a service position since that day until this one. And I've always give everything that I've ever done in Alcoholics Anonymous 100%. You know, and, you know, thank God for those guys who taught me that stuff, you know, that they didn't care about how I felt about things. They cared more about saving my life, and they would tell me the truth, you know, and I'm so grateful for those guys. And so, you know, I got real active. The guys started taking me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I couldn't read too good. And he told me, he said, "Read the first 164 pages, and it took me a while, and I was proud. I told him, I'm done, you know. He said, "Read it again." And I was like, "Man, you know." And I went and told him I was done. Well, he told me to meet me over at the church early one Friday night. And I went in there early. And we went into the sanctuary. And he started reading the big book to me. And he started explaining stuff. He started sharing his experience on working these steps. And we talked a lot about powerlessness and unmanageability, you know. And see, I didn't have a clue. And he read the doctor's opinion to me. You know, I didn't have a clue that once I put alcohol in my system, it sets off that phenomenon of craving. I didn't know that. I didn't know that that didn't happen to everybody. You know, my plan was, I'm getting drunk today, and I'll drink till I got drunk, you know. I never tried to quit drinking until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I didn't know what it was like to try to quit. And so, you know, there was no doubt in my mind when I came to in that hotel room on that bathroom floor that I was powerless over alcohol. I proved to myself in one night that I could not go out and drink a few beers. I proved that to myself, you know. And he read the book to me, you know. He told me, he said, "Mike, you have to concede to your innermost self that you're alcoholic. That somehow, someday, you're going to be able to beat the game, man. Somehow, someday, you're going to be able to drink and control your drinking. Those thoughts have to be smashed." And there was no doubt in my mind that I couldn't drink. You know, there's no doubt in my mind. And so we moved on. We started talking about God, you know. He read something out of that book to me, and he said, you know, thousands of men and women, worldly indeed, that flatly declared that since they came to believe in a power greater than themselves, took a certain attitude toward that power, did a few simple things, they've had a revolutionary change in the way they live and think. And man, that's exactly what's happened to me as a result of taking that certain attitude. You know, I believed in God, but I never had faith in it. I never saw Him, never heard Him, never felt Him. I didn't have any faith in God when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't not believe that there wasn't one. Growing up in the home that I grew up in, I knew my grandparents had a God in their life. And my mama, I knew that. So there was, you know, I couldn't say that God was nothing. I couldn't say that. And so, you know, we talked a lot about God. And he asked me, do you pray? And I said, I don't know how to. You know, what do you ask for? And so we talked a lot about the third step. We talked a lot about selfishness and self-centeredness. And he said that we think is the root of our problem. He read something to me that said that we invariably find that there was times in our past that we made decisions based on self that put us in a position to be hurt. I've done that my whole life. From the time I was 15, when I drank every day, I was self-will run riot. I made my own rules. I didn't care about y'all's rules. I run my own life, you know, selfishness and self-centered to the extreme, you know, so that, you know, I could identify with everything this guy was sharing with me and what he was reading to me, you know. And the first two steps, he said, all that is being convinced of what? That I'm powerless over alcohol, my life's unmanageable, and that God could and would if he were sought, you know, that he can restore me to sanity. And we talked a lot about insanity. You know, and he said, you know, I didn't know, have a clue that alcoholism centered in my mind. You know, I didn't know that after 8 months of coming and sitting in these meetings, and have you ever sat in a second step meeting where everybody wants to talk about all the insane things they do while they drink? That's not what it's talking about. What it's talking about is I'm sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous for 8 months, and I'm as dry as you can get off of alcohol. And the thought come to my mind that you can drink a couple beers. It'll be all right. It'll be different this time. That's the insanity of alcoholism that he was, you know, sharing with me. And so, you know, I could understand that. I could relate to that stuff, you know. We got out and we prayed that third step prayer right out of the big book. And I remember we got up off our knees and he said, I want you to remember that prayer. I want you to read that prayer every morning on your knees. And he got me right into an inventory. He had his with him. And he showed me how to do it, you know. And I remember I would go to my group, you know, my home group, and everybody in that group knew what I was doing. And you'd walk in there and they'd say, are you praying? You can't lie to these people. It's hard to lie to these people, man, I'm telling you. And I'd say, well, no, you know. I'd say, well, you need to start praying, you know. And my sponsor would say, he would say, Mike, why don't you, when you at night, take your boots off, throw them up under the bed, and in the morning, get down on your knees and pull your boots out, and while you're down there, talk to God. He likes to hear from strangers, you know. And so I just started doing that, you know. I was willing to do anything this guy suggested me to do, you know. And I knew this guy wouldn't steer me wrong. I knew that. And so, you know, I just started doing all this stuff, you know. The next few steps, it was all about pulling my life out of me, you know. It was all about getting my life on paper. You know, all those deep, dark secrets, resentments, hates, fears, you know, all that stuff, man. I didn't have a clue that that's what was blocking me from God my whole life. And I was able to get all that stuff out on paper and, you know, share it with my sponsor and you know, and get some guidance on what to do with it, you know. And, you know, what an amazing experience. I'm so glad that I did that stuff. I was just willing. I was desperate enough to do it, you know. And, you know, I did that. When I was 3 years sober, you know, I was going to a lot of conventions. That's where I met my second sponsor, Buck. And I started going all over the country with Buck. He used to record stuff. And for 33 years, he did that. And him and Virginia took me everywhere they went for 8.5 years, you know. And Buck became my sponsor, and he started taking me through the steps again, and he took me through the steps. And my life just kept getting better and better and better, you know. I would travel with Buck, I'd come back home, and I'd go to my home group, and they had a group conference. They'd say, congratulations. I'm like, for what? you're the new corrections rep. I'm like, am I? Okay, show me how. And they take me out to the prison. Well, I walked into the prison out there, and there's a guy here that used to take a meeting out to that same prison. And I walked up to the gate, you know, and I walked in this prison, and I looked like an inmate for one thing. But I walked in there, and five of my old drinking buddies are doing time in this prison. Three of them are in the AA meeting, and one of them we took our first drink together. He was 9 and I was 11. And but I'll tell you, man, I'd go into this prison, you know, and I went in there for the next year and a half, twice a week, you know. And I'd go in there, and they had the DART program in there. It was a treatment, 28-day treatment. And every 28 days, they'd rotate inmates across the state in there. And every 28 days, one of my old drinking buddies would come in there. You know, it was like, that's where I belong, you know. That's where I am when I drink. I'm going to end up with these guys, you know, and I don't want to end up with these guys. And but what a great experience that was, you know. I remember they would come in to count the inmates, and they'd go back out, and they'd come back in and count them again. And they'd go back out, and they'd come back and say, everybody from the outside raise their hand. I'd raise my hand, and they counted me as an inmate every time. I'm serious. I went in there one time. I went to the canteen, right? And it was out on the yard, and all the inmates were walking the yard. And there's a big line, and I'm standing at the canteen. Somebody yells, clear the yard. Well, I ain't never heard them say that. So everybody takes off running, and I walk up to the front of the line. And sheriff comes around the side of the building and said, I said to clear the yard. He jacked me up on the wall. And the guy in the canteen said, he's from the outside, Sergeant. He's from the outside. I said, yeah, I'm from the outside. He didn't say, I'm sorry. He said, this is your lucky day, boy. And he turned me loose. Man, I run into the AA meeting, man. I'm telling you. That guy in the canteen said, boy, you's getting ready to get 30 days in the hole, man. I'm like, good God. I'm just coming to the AA meeting. And but, man, I've had some amazing experience, man. I've had the privilege of going into 16 different prisons in my sobriety. And I was trying to remember, back in the 90s, I came to Noonan, Georgia, and I worked for 14 days, and I went to meetings all around this area, and I had came to this conference, and Tony C., a local here, was one of the speakers at that conference. I remember that. And but, man, I was down there in Noonan, Georgia. I went there. The first night I was there, I called an AA number, and it was a woman who didn't go to AA anymore, and she told me where the club was, or it was like an old house. And I went in there, and the guy said, does anybody want to go to the prison tomorrow night? I said, I do. And so I went over there, and he took me in there, and, you know, the inmates in the prison there said, we want him to come tell his story next week. So I was able to go back in there twice. And but that's the way my sobriety's been, man. I've had just so many awesome experiences like that. When I was 3 years sober, I had me in a nice apartment, you know. And I'm going to tell you, I never owned anything my whole life. I didn't get an education, you know. I've never owned anything. And so I started collecting all these antique furniture, you know. I had a matching bedroom suit from the early 1900s. Beautiful stuff. And I remember I was proud of this stuff, man. You know, I'd invite AA people over and we listened to speaker tapes, you know, and I was proud of this stuff. And I remember one night late, I went home from a meeting, and about 2 o'clock in the morning, I turned my TV off. And sometime during the night, I rolled over and my arm went underwater. Now you can imagine what I thought. And I thought, well, I don't drink no more. I don't do that no more. I quit drinking. Right? Well, I jumped out of bed and the water was waist deep. And I was in shock, you know. And I remember I had a camera on my entertainment center, and I grabbed it and I started flashing it. And, you know, these apartment complexes, there was two apartment complexes, and there was a creek that run right through the middle of it, a creek that I used to drink on growing up as a kid. And when the water rises, you know, there's snakes and rats, all in that stuff. And I thought, man, I got to get some clothes on, you know. It flooded out 280 apartments that morning. It was a Sunday morning at daybreak. And it was waist deep. And I remember I went and got some clothes on, and I walked out my back door, and the water come up to my chest. And I couldn't get on my knees that morning. And I looked up, and I said, God, help me. And God answered my prayer. Help people get out. And I started helping my neighbors get out. You know. And then finally, rescue people came, got me out. And I got out of there, and I went, and I called my first sponsor, and AA showed up. 6:30 on a Sunday morning. These guys brought me a hot thermos full of coffee and some dry clothes, and they stayed with me until 1:30 that afternoon. And we followed that water line back in, and we walked into that apartment, and I had lost everything. My van was underwater for 7 hours. And I remember we walked back in that bedroom where I had that antique bedroom suit. And we were standing there, and that first sponsor, he looked at me, he said, "Mike, cry if you need to." And he hugged me, and he cried with me. Because I was proud of that stuff, you know. And he told me something I thought was pretty crazy. He said, "Mike, maybe God wants you to have better stuff." And I'm going to tell y'all something. I wasn't feeling it right then. I was not feeling it. But he took me in his home, you know, and AA took care of me for the next month, man. They took me to meetings. They picked me up. They took me to work. They picked me up, you know. They was even, my grand sponsor's brother was still drunk. He come over there and put a rebuilt carburetor on my van, got it running again. But, you know, they took care of me, you know. And my sponsor was real, real strong on, you know, you need to keep your commitments. You need to do this. You need to do that. And I kept my commitments. I kept doing the work in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sponsoring a couple guys. I was going out of the prisons. You know, I was doing all this stuff, you know, and I just kept doing it. That was on a Sunday morning. Monday, I went to work. And they said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "Well, I ain't got nowhere else to go, right? This is where I go in the daytime." And and y'all never believe this. You know, I got fired back in the 80s at this company, and I went back to work for them when I was in treatment. And they hired me back at $6.35 an hour, working on an assembly line. Now, I've sponsored guys that won't take a job under 14 an hour. I sponsored this guy one time. They offered him $12 starting out, and he didn't take the job. And he came to me and he said, "They ain't going to pay enough." I said, "Well, how much did they offer you?" He said, $12 an hour. I said, "Man, you're crazy." I said, "That's a $12 an hour raise for you, right?" So, you know, $6.35 an hour was $6.35 an hour raised for me. And I was proud. I said, "Yeah, I'll take it," you know. I got into this place and I started working for them. And I worked hard for these people. You know, they fired me back in the 80s. And I was there for a year. I picked up a welder one time. I never picked up a welder in my life. And I started welding a little bit. And my boss man come over and said, "Did you weld that?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Come on." And he started me welding. And he jacked my pay up. And you'll never believe what I was building. I was building jail bars and prison bars. And I'll tell you, man, I'd build this big set of jail bars. And, you know, I knew the bell rung at 4:30. We'd go home, you know, about, I don't know, 4:20. I just lean on them bars. I look all through the bars, you know. And that buzzer would go off. And I'd go right around the edge of them and go to the house. Just happy as I'd be, you know. Just as grateful as I'd be. And I worked 13 years for this company, man, my first 13 years sober, you know, and it was absolutely amazing. It was absolutely amazing. You know, I had, I sat in this meeting today on the 8th step over here and at 4 o'clock meeting, and I was sitting there thinking, you know, I never had the willingness to go make amends to anybody. I was scared, man. You know, I was afraid to go back and clean up the records of my past. And I remember the first amends that I made that was on my list was put in front of me. And it was a woman who kicked me out of her life and her family's life. Didn't ever want to see me again. And I was able to clean up that mess. And just the effects from that, making the amends, was absolutely incredible. That, you know, I don't ever have to hide from this woman again. I don't ever have to feel that shame or guilt anymore. You know, and the effects of doing that made me want to do the rest of them, you know. And I was diligent about making my amends and cleaning up the records of my past. I don't know how many of you sat in a meeting, you know, and there's a guy sitting over there just got out of treatment with 28 days and the promises are coming true in my life, you know. I'm going to tell you, I never had a clue on how free I could be, you know, because I was looking over my back when I come into Alcoholics Anonymous. They were out to get, y'all know who they are? I don't know who they are. But they were going to get me sooner or later. And I'm not afraid of to them anymore. You know, I don't look over my shoulder anymore. That freedom that I got from cleaning up the rags of my past is absolutely incredible. You know, and if you're here and if you're sitting on that ninth step, man, get out there and do the work, man, because it is unbelievable the freedom that you can get from doing that. You know, I've had the privilege of sponsoring a lot of guys, and you know, and cleaning up the wreckage of my past. You know, there was family members I didn't see for 20 years because, you know, I just didn't want to have anything to do with Christian people. My family was all active, you know, in church, and I just didn't, you know, and I know today is I didn't want to go around my family because I didn't want them to see me in the condition I got myself into because I looked like a wild animal. I didn't want them to see me living like that, so I didn't go around them. You know, so I, you know, when I cleaned up and, you know, I had bought me a suit, I went back in this Lutheran church I grew up in to find family members that was on my list. And I went in and I was standing there talking to the preacher. And I went early on a Sunday morning. And I remember I was standing there and a woman came up and grabbed me and hugged my neck and said, "Mike, where you been?" And it was a cousin I hadn't seen in 20 years. And I got to take her to lunch that day and let her know where I've been for the last 20 years. And And I remember a couple weeks after that, her mom invited me over for dinner. And when I pulled up to her house, I noticed there was a lot of cars on that road. And I walked in this house, and my aunt had put together a family reunion of family members I hadn't seen in 20 years, new family members I never met before. You know, so that was incredible. And they gifted me with all kind of family stuff, man. I've got my mama when she was 2 years old on DVD today. In 1937, and that's when my grandparents adopted her when she was 2 years old. I've got that stuff, man. I never would have seen that stuff if I hadn't been making these amends. You know, so some incredible things have happened, you know. And I remember back in 1996, I went to visit with my mom, and we've never been real close. And I went up to this house I grew up in, and she was living by herself. And I remember I walked in this house, it was around Thanksgiving, and it was so cold in there you could see your breath. And I remember I walked in the kitchen and I opened up the refrigerator and it was empty. And I looked at my mom and she looked like she was starving to death, man. She was just skinny and she wasn't 4'9". And she took me back into her bedroom. We went through the living room, all her furniture was gone. And we went back in her bedroom and she had a little tiny heater back there. And she closed the door, and she had a blanket to go over the door. And she was just trying to stay warm back there. And I remember I sat down, and I asked my mom, I said, "What's wrong?" And my mom had lost her job in April, and she didn't tell nobody. And she was selling her furniture to pay her bills. And my wife, my mama has helped people her whole life. When I was a little tiny kid, man, when I was like 4 years old, my mom was a school teacher. And she taught handicapped kids at the elementary school that I went to. And she actually, back in the 60s, she taught herself out of medical books. And she went and took a test and became an RN. And she went to work in the ER in Charlotte at the Presbyterian Hospital for years. And she got into, you know, all kind of different things in nursing. And then when her parents got sick, she quit her job and lived on their Social Security and took care of both of her parents. And they both died at home. And after they died, my mom went back to nursing and she couldn't do it anymore. So she took a patient and she was going to start taking patients in her home that were only supposed to live 2 or 3 months. And then she'd get a new patient. So I helped her set up a room like a hospital room. And I remember the first woman she got lived for 3 years. And she became part of the family. And it just killed my mom, you know, when she lost her too, you know. And she said, "I can't do this anymore." So she started taking care of infant babies, you know, and she's always taking care of somebody, you know. And here she was, and she was by herself, and she was, you know, looked like she was starving. She was living in this house with no heat. They had already turned her gas off, you know. And I remember I went home that night, and I was sitting in my apartment with all this better stuff as a result of that flood I was in. And I used to say I thought I'd be selfish if I didn't go help my mom. I really believe today that it was, you know, that was God's way of putting me and her in each other's life where maybe we can form some kind of relationship we've never had. And I went back home. You know, here I am in my 30s and I want to come back home. And so I was able to take all that stuff back up to my mom's and share it with her. And, you know, I'd come to meetings and I'd ask you guys, I'd say, "Why can I come in here and hug any one of you and tell you I love you? And I can't even do that with my own mama." And they said, all you got to do is just do it. And it was hard. I couldn't do it. And I remember one night she came down the hall and I grabbed my mom and I hugged her and told her I loved her. The first time I can ever remember doing that. And she said, I love you too. And it got easier. And I started doing it every day. We started sitting and talking with each other. We actually became pretty good friends as a result of that. And she told me a lot of things about my family I didn't know. She told me about my dad that I never met. He was my number one resentment. He left my mom with four kids and never sent her a dime. I hated that man. She told me my dad grew up on the streets of Charlotte, North Carolina. Said he'd been locked up hundreds of times, public drunk. Went to prison for armed robbery. My mama told me I was just like him. When she told me that, man, the resentment washed away. Because what I realized was, if I would have been, you know, in that same situation, man, if I would have had four kids, if I'd have had one kid, the way I was living my life out in the streets of Charlotte drinking, there's no way I could have took care of that kid. And so I forgave that man. I forgive him. And years later, I wrote him a letter. I didn't know where he was at. And I found out he was out in Grants Pass, Oregon, and I was able to send him the letter and let him know I didn't hate him. You know, and I got to talk to my dad on the phone before he died, man. What an incredible thing. I got to let him know that, man, you know, even though he did leave them four kids and never give them a dime, this kid actually forgave me, you know. What an awesome thing that is. And I don't have to carry that anymore, you know, and he don't either. And so, you know, I learned a lot of things as a result of that. And I remember in 98, I was supposed to go up to Blackstone, Virginia with my sponsor then. And my mom was sick, and I told Buck, I said, I can't go. And he said, why not? I said, my mom's sick. And them nurses are the hardest ones to get to go to the doctor, I'm telling you. And I remember I took my mom up to the hospital on a Thursday morning, and I stayed with her till 7 o'clock that evening. And my mom said, Mike, there's nothing you can do here. You need to be with those AA people up in Virginia. You know, she didn't know who y'all were, but she loved y'all. Because y'all saved her baby boy's life. She loved y'all. And I remember I left and went up to Blackstone, and when I got back, I called her doctor, and her doctor told me, said, Mike, your mama has terminal lung cancer, and she's not going to live long. And I said, well, how long is that? And he said, maybe 3 months. And, man, I was tore up, you know. Here I am, I finally have a relationship with my mom, and now she's going to be leaving, you know. And I remember I brought my mom home, and I was able to take care of my mom. And I tell you, that was a hard thing to do. And I remember late at night, my mama would climb in my bed, and she'd put her hand on my shoulder, and she'd be crying like a little baby. And I didn't know what to do, you know. I would just hold her in my arms and tell her I loved her. I didn't know what to say to her to make her feel any better, you know. And I was reflecting on the past and all the damage that I did in that home growing up as a kid. I went on these railroad tracks one time drinking Everclear, chasing it with long neck Budweiser. I don't remember coming off them tracks. My mama knew about alcoholism. I came to the next day on the living room floor of that house, and my mama was laying on the floor holding me in her arms through my sickness. She knew I was sick. She was taking care of her baby boy. And I remember I climbed up off the floor and I looked around that house and I had broke everything you could break in that house in a drunken rage. Don't even remember doing it. I never thought my alcoholism affected anybody. I didn't know the fear that I put in my family, you know, as a result of my drinking. And so, you know, I had the privilege of being there with my mom and taking care of her, you know, for the next 3 months. And I was there with her when she died. And I remember a hospice came in. And my mom, being a nurse, and she wants the best for her baby boy, she tried to hook me up with a head hospice nurse, right? I didn't have the heart to tell my mama that she was gay, you know, it probably wouldn't work out. But I was able to be there, you know, and take care of my mom. And I was there with her when she died, you know. What an honor and privilege that was to be there. She left me in my childhood home. It wasn't long after that I ran into my future wife here. And believe it or not, she's a hospice nurse. Not the same one, but... But we have an incredible life, you know. When we started dating, we had a dream of building a log cabin on a mountain. The dream came true. We built a log cabin on top of a mountain. We lived up there for 3 years, and we found out we can still make bad decisions. And the house went into foreclosure, and everybody'd say, "Man, we're sorry y'all lost the house." I said, "We didn't lose it. It's still sitting up on that hill. We just don't live in it anymore, right?" And you know, the great thing about it is a lot of people told us to file bankruptcy, you know. And we went and seen a lawyer, and we did all the paperwork and everything, but we didn't sign the paper. And we come out of there, and we didn't like the way we felt. You know, it's not our money. It's their money. And we're paying them back every cent we owe them, you know. And so, you know, and we feel good about that, man. A lot of great things has come because of doing that, you know. It's absolutely incredible when you do the right thing. You know, and I love that promise in the third step, that if we stay close to Him and perform His work well, He'll provide for us. You know, me and my wife, we're provided for, man. We have an awesome life. We take drunks in our home all the time. We've had drunks convulse in the bathroom floor in our home, you know. But we love working with drunks, you know. And my home group today, I love my home group. It's the big town group in Etowah. And if you're ever up in Western North Carolina in the Blue Ridge Mountains, come and see us. We got a website, bigtownaagroup.com. You come on up down there. And our group is real active. We believe in the fifth tradition, you know. We carry the message to the alcoholic. We don't just sit and wait on the drunks to come to us. We get out in the community, you know. We go to two different jails every week. We've got big town group members in these two different jails every week. We've got them in detox every week. You know, we had the privilege and honor of sending Big Books, Grapevines, and CDs to two different groups over in Mosul, Iraq for a year and a half, man. What a great thing that was. To be able to get emails from these military guys that's over there in Iraq about 5-6 years ago. And it was incredible, you know. It was absolutely amazing. Love that group. And we have a strong line of sponsorship in that group. And, you know, we're committed to Alcoholics Anonymous and carrying the message to the suffering alcoholic, you know. I heard a story, and a woman that was supposed to be here this weekend, I heard this story back in 93 down in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And she told a story about this man walks down the beach every morning. And this one morning he was walking, and he saw way off in the distance, somebody was picking something up and throwing it in the ocean. Well, when he got closer, he saw where thousands of starfish washed up on the beach. And he got closer down there, and he asked the man, he said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Well, I'm throwing these starfish back in the ocean." And the guy said, "What difference can you make, man? There's thousands of them. There's thousands of them." And he reached down and he picked one more up, and he said, "It makes all the difference in the world of this one." And he threw them back in the ocean. I can identify with that story, the way our book talks about the way we roar through people's lives like a tornado. I know today that my alcoholism affected pretty much everybody I come in contact with somehow out there when I was drinking. And I really believe that the wind stopped blowing that morning I ended up in that courtroom. I know today that that judge knew more about me than I knew about myself. That judge was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And out of the thousands of drunks that went through that courtroom, I was one that he picked up and threw in the rooms of AA. And as a result of becoming willing to ask another man to help me, to do everything that this man suggests I do, and to try to work these steps to the best of my ability and practice those principles behind these steps a day at a time in my life, there's no doubt in my mind that this program saved my life. And if you're new here, I guarantee you, if you work these 12 steps with a sponsor, it'll save your life too. Thank y'all for having me up here tonight.
Mike, thank you very much for a fine AA talk, and as a token of the appreciation from the conference committee, we'd like to present you with this gift. And with that, I think we will clear the room quickly upon completion of the prayer so that the talented membership, or not so talented as the case may be, can do what they need to do and get things set up. So once again, Mike, thank you very much for sharing with us this evening. And for all who care to, we will close the meeting with the Lord's Prayer.